This is Colorado Edition from KUNC. On today's show, we'll get cooking ahead of Thanksgiving.
This is a TV commercial cookie. Everything's been done to this one.
And tell you what you need to know for baking at high altitudes.
Plus, the controversy over actions by an online outdoor retailer.
The backlash was unexpected, impressive, and quite large.
All that and more is coming up.
It's Monday, November 25th. You're listening to KUNC's Colorado Edition, your look at news from around the state. I'm Henry Zimmerman.
And I'm Erin O'Toole. Last week, we brought you a few conversations about the debate around whether or not to map flow lines in our state. Flow lines are the underground pipelines that connect oil and gas wells to storage tanks. The Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission voted on Thursday night and approved new rules for regulating flow lines. KUNC's Matt Bloom was at that vote and joins us now to explain what's next. Hey, Matt.
Hey, Erin.
So the commission spent a lot of time last week considering this new set of rules. What did they approve?
So there's three main things to take away here: mapping, reactivating, and removing flow lines. So the COGCC, that's the state's oil and gas regulator, is going to start providing information about where flow lines are in an online map. So you can go on and see it. The other part, abandonment, basically oil and gas companies will have to remove abandoned flow lines from the ground. And that's different from before, where they could just leave them there after they were abandoned. There was unanimous support from this from the Oil and Gas Commission and from a lot of the people involved in the discussion.
Before the vote, you told us about the debate over how closely the public should be able to see the location of flow lines on maps. What did the COGCC land on?
That was actually a really big topic of debate during the hearings. How accurate do these maps need to be? Less accurate means that they can get this information out faster, but more accurate means obviously you can see where these lines are. So they settled on a sort of compromise of plus or minus 25 feet where you should be able to tell where one of these lines is buried. Some people were pushing for even closer than that, plus or minus 3 feet, like Erin Martinez, a survivor of the 2017 explosion in Firestone.
We spoke with Martinez last week, and she told us about this search for an abandoned well in the backyard of her new home.
We saw Anadarko trucks in the field behind our house, and you could tell that they were digging and they were searching for something, and apparently they were trying to locate a plugged and abandoned well because they were going to start the second phase of construction behind our home, and they couldn't find it. You know, it was clear that they had no idea where it was at.
Obviously, wells are different from flow lines, but the principle is the same. I mean, how will mapping work for companies that don't know where their equipment is?
It's a really good question. Martinez brought that issue up several times during the hearing. Oil and gas operators now have to go out into the field, remove the flow lines if they're abandoned. And if they don't know where they are, they have to search for them. They have to find them. The COGCC also asked for an audit to see how these new rules are working over the next year and if companies are complying.
And Matt, what's been the industry response to these new rules?
They're much more receptive to these changes than I think some other ideas we've heard over the last year. A couple concerns they had were about the level of detail you could see these lines on the map. Lynn Granger was there at the hearing till the very end. She's the director of API Colorado. It's an industry trade group.
We want to be able to provide publicly available data and be as transparent as possible. I think our chief concern there was we don't want that to take the place of the 811 call before you dig. We definitely want people to make sure they do that.
They also feel like it's possible to safely abandon flow lines in the ground, so they were happy to see a few exceptions written into these rules.
When will this information start to be publicly available?
The COGCC's director said they'd immediately start uploading this information. You can find it on their website or just Google COGCC map. There is a process that the rules have to go through. They have to be published in the state register. So it seems like they're aiming for early next year for all of these rules to go into effect. The thing to remember is there are thousands of these lines around the state. Some of them were buried decades ago. So there's a grace period that older wells can be added over the next year.
This was the first major rule change since Senate Bill 181 passed earlier this year, changing the priorities of the COGCC from fostering the industry to protecting health and public safety. What is next for the commission?
Well, they've got several big changes coming up, including rewriting their entire mission statement. that'll be one to watch. Those are going to be happening early next year. My takeaway from watching the commission debate the new flow line rules is that they're going to be very focused on changing things in a way that really prioritizes public health and safety.
Matt Bloom is a reporter for KUNC. Matt, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Now let's take a look at today's headlines.
Now, we know the snow is top of mind as you plan for holiday travel, and the National Weather Service says we could see more than a foot of snow here along the Front Range.
Which means roads on Wednesday could be busier than expected. That's because some drivers who expected to travel earlier in the week for Thanksgiving could be delayed by the storm, according to AAA Colorado's Skylar McKinley.
If I had to look into my crystal ball, I would say most of the people who plan to travel still plan on traveling. The roads are just going to be that much more hectic on Wednesday.
A record number of Coloradans, 960,000, are still expected to travel for the four-day weekend. AAA Colorado recommends planning additional time if you're driving.
Tonight's winter storm has prompted some airlines at Denver International Airport to waive rebooking fees for flights scheduled to leave the airport over the next day. Southwest Airlines, United, and Delta are already offering the waivers as an option for travelers. And DIA spokesperson Emily Williams says they'll have some amenity kits and blankets for travelers who do end up spending the night at the airport. If you're traveling tonight or tomorrow, Williams says it's important to check your flight status and leave as early as possible to account for slow traffic along Peña Boulevard.
The winter storm may have an impact on avalanche conditions in mountain communities as well. Early season snowfall in October, followed by more dry conditions through November, have made for a weak snowpack foundation in backcountry areas. Brian Lazar is deputy director for the Colorado Avalanche Information Center.
In places where that recent storm snow fell on top of that pre-existing weak snow, we had a bunch of small avalanche activity and shooting cracks and audible collapses. Avalanche conditions had worsened and the hazard had increased.
Lazar says if you're planning on traveling in backcountry areas, to not go alone, be prepared for worst-case situations with appropriate gear and training, and most of all, check conditions before you go.
And we're already hearing about school closures around our area. Estes Park, Thompson, and Poudre school districts are among those announcing closures on Tuesday due to the weather. Stay warm.
It's common to see streams dry up at certain times of the year in the arid West. The causes vary from depleted groundwater to heavy diversion for cities and farms. But just because the water's disappeared, it doesn't mean it's gone forever. From Arizona Public Media, Ariana Brocious has more on a newly revived stretch of the Santa Cruz River in Tucson.
Much of the Santa Cruz River is a dry, desert wash, only flowing after heavy monsoon rains. As Tucson water hydrologist Dick Thompson and I walk along the river south of Star Pass, he points out how brown the vegetation looks.
So there's no water coming out at the stretch we're looking at here.
Right, it's dry as a bone.
We walk down the dry riverbed to where a pipe in the side of the embankment is releasing treated wastewater into the channel. As we get closer, the vegetation changes from brown to green. Soon, we can see a shallow rock-bottomed pond surrounded by grasses. We're joined by aquatic ecologist and U of A professor Michael Bogan.
The wetland vegetation is really starting to come in here, so we see things like cattails and sedges and this yerba mansa. So it's looking a lot more like a natural cienega or marsh.
Bogan says as soon as the water started to flow, bugs and animals started to show up, flying or hopping in from other areas nearby.
Day one, we saw 7 species of dragonflies within hours of the water being released.
And more soon followed. At last count, Bogan says they've seen 41 species of dragonflies here, which represents 80% of those native to the lower Santa Cruz River. And it's not just insects. Toads, birds, and other wildlife also visit the little oasis.
Are those coyotes?
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of coyotes down here.
Many of those species rely on a permanent water source, which this revived stretch of the Santa Cruz has now become.
The species that we're seeing here so far are still a subset of all the species that could be here or that probably historically were here. But the river is essentially only 4 months old at this point, right? So that's not a surprise.
This is an artificial river. It's a dry wash.
That's Dick Thompson with Tucson Water.
We're supplementing the water that's gone now. Over 100 years ago, there was enough groundwater, there was enough rainwater, enough groundwater that you had intermittent flows. And some places stayed wet all year round. That's all gone to overpumping of the aquifer.
Thompson says this project offered the city a new place to store treated wastewater, which it needed because its other storage basins are full.
You could think of recharge basins and the river as a bank, where you're putting money in your bank. Sometime in the future, when you need that water, you can pump it back out.
Along with creating new riparian habitat, Thompson says the project is reconnecting people with a flowing river.
The public gets to see it and see how just a little bit of water makes such a profound difference.
And he says when those people hear about water scarcity problems in other watersheds in Arizona and the West,
they can think back to this and say, I've seen that. I've seen what a little bit of water does. I can't imagine that they're drying out other places.
Today, ecologist Michael Bogan is on the hunt for damselflies.
All these little toothpicks flying around.
They're kind of like blue toothpicks.
Yeah, exactly. Blue toothpicks.
The prevalence of all these insects is directly tied to the high quality of this wastewater. Sonoran Institute ecologist Claire Zugmeyer says the county upgraded its treatment process in 2013.
So the big change that made a difference for aquatic life is the removal of ammonia and other forms of nitrogen that are very, very common in wastewater.
Zugmeyer says her group has been monitoring the two other wastewater-fed stretches of the Santa Cruz for the last decade. She's excited about this latest project, even while it may not be a totally natural river.
This stretch of the river used to flow year-round, so it has this great cultural, historical meaning, too. And even if it can't be exactly what it was, we have a little bit of a glimpse into the past.
After a couple minutes of searching, Michael Bogan returns with a beautiful discovery.
It's a common green darner dragonfly that's still emerging out of its larval skin.
He says the colorful dragonfly is probably 3 or 4 months old, born here at this riparian oasis. I'm Ariana Brocious in Tucson, Arizona.
This story is part of ongoing coverage of the Colorado River, produced in partnership with Arizona Public Media and with support from the Walton Family Foundation. You can find more at our website, kunc.org.
You're listening to Colorado Edition from KUNC.
We're going to turn to a brewing controversy over a company, Backcountry.com. The online retailer based in Utah has been suing anyone who uses the word backcountry, including an e-bike company, an avalanche education clinic, and a denim company, among others.
And now, after a huge backlash, the company is working to make amends, just in time for Black Friday. Here to explain what's happening is the reporter who broke the whole story, Jason Blevins of the Colorado Sun. Welcome to Colorado Edition, Jason.
Thank you, Henry.
So catch our listeners up. Why is this company able to sue other companies who use the word backcountry?
Backcountry.com has about a 10-year-old trademark for online retail store activities. You know, it's an online retailer. And the company in the past couple of years has branched out, started branding its own gear. And as they've done that, they have quietly, through the USPTO, the United States Patent and Trade Office, filed objections to existing trademarks, companies that have trademarks. And they have pursued those trademarks because they want them. And in the process, they've filed 4 federal lawsuits against small business owners.
Why is the company doing this? Does it really affect their business for there to be other companies with the same name, or is it a different reason altogether?
Trademark law is interesting. You know, if you have a trademark, you need to prove that you have gone out and enforced it and said, don't use this name. That's our name. They have a service trademark, and it's a descriptor. You know, it's sort of, backcountry is a pretty commonly, it's a place, right? And it's a pretty commonly used word. There's a number of businesses out there, dozens, that use that word. But it seems like these guys had really wanted to go out and expand their business. So they wanted to expand their collection of trademarks, and other people had those trademarks. So they had to challenge those trademarks and go after them. And what was, I guess, interesting here was seeing them go after almost exclusively really small businesses, single owner operator type of businesses. One person who was trying to start a new idea, an innovator, sort of the people who really make up the backbone of the outdoor recreation business community.
After you reported on the practice this company has, it began to face a big backlash. What happened?
Lots of people in this community, in the backcountry community, sort of rallied around these small businesses. There's a Facebook page called boycottbackcountry.com, and it, within a matter of days, had more than 20,000 members on it. And they were all, you know, calling for a boycott on backcountry.com. The backlash was unexpected, impressive, and quite large.
Backcountry.com apologized. They released an open letter on their website. Backcountry.com CEO Jonathan Nielsen wrote, "We made a mistake." Explain that apology and how it went over for the people who were pretty upset.
They posted something online, you know, said, "We're sorry." But then they had that crazy but, you know, when anyone says, "We're sorry, but," you kind of have to raise your eyebrows a little bit. And they said, "But these lawsuits followed respectful and amicable requests for people to, you know, basically abandon their marks." And having a bunch of emails that the company's trademark lawyers had sent, you know, we posted some of those emails up, and it became pretty obvious that there was nothing respectful or amicable when these trademark lawyers, who were not in-house lawyers, they'd hired a trademark law firm, were going after companies. And it certainly did not appear to be in any way respectful or amicable. And the company circled back on that apology a few days later and really doubled down and said, "Okay, we're not just going to say we're sorry, we're actually doing something." So they really launched into what has been a pretty impressive apology tour by the backcountry.com CEO, Jonathan Nielsen. He's reached a deal with the last remaining federal lawsuit that was out there with a ski maker from the Upper Peninsula in Michigan. They have partnered with his company and will start promoting his product. He's partnered with a coffee maker in Boulder who was forced to rebrand when threatened with a federal lawsuit. These deals are pretty impressive. They've definitely taken a step beyond saying, "We're sorry, we shouldn't have done that."
Is that a common move in the business world, or is that pretty unprecedented?
From what I gather, it is pretty unprecedented. And talking with folks who are these business owners, there's a sense that this has something to do with the backcountry community. The backcountry community is very, very tight knit. And sort of the overarching message from this boycott backcountry.com website of Facebook is, this is an important word. And if you're going to use this word, you need to, you know, sort of accept a backcountry ethos, which is, it doesn't have hubris. You know, if you're cocky in the backcountry, you're not going to spend much time in the backcountry. It's not a place that forgives hubris. So I think, you know, the company seems to recognize that there's a responsibility with that name, and there's a respectfulness that needs to be carried, and a humility maybe that needs to be displayed when you have that word in your business title. And they seem to have recognized that, and they're going out and forging very innovative deals that are really floating these businesses, which is what these business owners have always wanted.
Is there a sense that that's enough in the eyes of people who were otherwise boycotting them?
There's a lot of people on that boycott backcountry.com page, and some of them are very angry. So there's a lot more work to do. I don't know if this is finished. The list of aggrieved business owners is very long, and some of them are very aggrieved. They're very injured. They lost everything. So I don't know if it's enough. Only time will tell, but we can tell from the first steps the company has taken that they seem sincere.
Jason Blevins is a writer for the Colorado Sun. You can find links to his reporting at our website, kunc.org. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good to be here.
As Thanksgiving looms, you may be thinking about what treats you'll be baking this week. But as you may have discovered, baking at higher altitudes, such as here in Colorado, is different than baking at lower altitudes. To find out more about what this actually means and what adjustments we should make to have our desserts not collapse before the big meal, we went to CSU to talk with some experts about baking at altitude. Marisa Bunning is a professor and extension specialist at Colorado State University. She began by explaining why Coloradans have become experts at high-altitude baking.
Colorado's always been looked to for providing high elevation guidance because, you know, the surrounding states call us and ask us what they need to do. Mm-hmm. So we've taken the lead many decades ago when researchers from CSU actually would go up to higher elevations and they didn't have a lab. So they took their equipment with them and worked in pretty primitive surroundings to try and better understand what the difference is with our environment here. We have a lighter blanket of air over us, and that impacts all kinds of food preparation.
Can you tell us a little bit about the science behind baking at high altitude, and why does altitude change
the way things come out?
It has to do with that lighter blanket of air. We have, because we are at higher elevation, we have less air pressure here. So things like when bread rises because of the yeast, mm-hmm. it can actually rise faster, and cakes as well. But it doesn't properly set. It doesn't get a structure before it rises to a point that actually collapses. So it seems like a good thing that things rise quickly, but it can, you know, turn into a product that doesn't turn out the way you want it to.
That's such a nice way of saying it collapsed. All right. So how about some practical tips for people? You know, you're looking at a recipe. What might be some quick adjustments that you could make?
We have some great information that's available, but the main things are you may need to adjust the time that you're cooking something.
The time. Uh-huh.
You may need to adjust the temperature, and you may need to adjust the recipe. So it can fall into those three things, and sometimes you might need to adjust all three.
So what would be an example of adjusting the recipe?
Because of the lower air pressure, leavening will actually work more efficiently here. So we suggest reducing the leavening. In other words, you may need to decrease the amount of baking soda or baking powder when you're baking cookies.
Okay. Yeah.
The other thing is, because of our drier climate, you may need to increase the liquid. And this might mean adding more eggs or using larger eggs or adding water.
Okay.
Okay. Another thing that may help is, especially with breads and cakes, you may need to raise the temperature of the oven, because that can help set the structure a little faster, and you can avoid the collapse of the baked product.
So, you know, we talked about some tips, and I know this is something that you're really interested in studying, but like why do these fixes work from a scientific standpoint?
That's interesting. I think you can always trace it back to the science, and because of that lighter blanket of air, that less pressure, and that explains why things can rise quicker here and why we make the adjustments that we do in leavening. And then with our drier climate, it has to do with the same issue of water evaporating faster here. So that would be why you would need to add more water. And with all the changes that can take place because of the differences, that's one of the reasons that you raise the temperature of the oven. But you always have to watch things closely, because that higher temperature will also have an impact on how long something will need to bake. So it's a trial and error process, and we recommend that people take very good notes as they're making changes, so they can remember what did and didn't work, so they can try it again.
That was Marisa Bunning, a professor and extension specialist at Colorado State University. This is a TV commercial cookie. Everything's been done to this one. The high altitude adjustments, the refrigeration of the dough. Trust me, it's golden, soft. Oh, yeah. Oh my gosh, this is so good. I'm not even kidding. And don't worry, we didn't forget about pie. Heidi Engelhardt, a master student of food science at CSU, gave us a few tips for baking pies at higher altitudes while we were there.
At higher elevations, because there is less pressure above us, the water can evaporate quicker. And one of the main ingredients in pie crust is water. And it's very pertinent that you hydrate the pie dough, again, with cold water, because you don't want the butter to melt, because that's what creates like the flakiness in the pie. Mm-hmm. So oftentimes you might just need to add a couple tablespoons extra of water, maybe to what the recipe says. Sometimes the recipe would give a range, but it's always nice to kind of feel the dough and make sure that it feels pretty hydrated. Mm-hmm. If you refrigerate it after it's been hydrated, again, that butter will harden up, and that will help the structure of your pie crust when it's being baked, because you don't want it to kind of melt, and that's when it will fall or get soggy. So making sure that it's properly hydrated, making sure that it doesn't feel dry before you shape it, and then refrigerating it, taking it back out, shaping it as quickly as you can, essentially, and then you can start filling your pie.
Is there anything special we should do with the filling?
For pumpkin pie, you should test the recipe first and then kind of see what happens. You might need to add an extra egg if you kind of need more structure, or it's possible for other pies that it could spill over. So maybe decreasing some of the ingredients, maybe some of the water ingredients, maybe a little less fruit, draining some of the water out if it's cooked or not cooked, because it's possible that it could spill over as well.
Okay, right. Mm-hmm. Maybe don't fill it up all the way too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thanks. I'm feeling more confident. Honestly, I know this isn't about me, but
for photos of our cooking adventures and even more information and tips about baking at high altitude, like what you need to know to get your mashed potatoes just right, go to kunc.org.
That's our show for today. Tomorrow, we explore an outdoor alternative to the traditional Thanksgiving meal. I'm Henry Zimmerman.
And I'm Erin O'Toole. Our show is produced by Lily Tyson. Brian Larson is our executive producer.
Thanks for listening. This is Colorado Edition from KUNC.